The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. As we head into our third hour, I'll share with you what I shared with our next guest. I woke up this morning. I didn't plan the show before today. I usually don't do it much in advance of the morning I wake up. And I, of course, knew it was 9/11. And I was thinking about who I wanted to speak with today. And I've had usual practices. I've had Susan Rescorla. I've often had Andy McCarthy on this day. And I woke up thinking, the man I want to talk to is the man I have. And I reached out to him, and he made himself available to us. He's one of my favorite people, and I know he has a tremendous insight into all we've talked about, the cultural effects of this day, this moment, as well as his own personal story. And that is Pete Peterson, my dear friend. Pete Peterson is the dean of the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine. Pete, normally one would say happy something, but yeah. You don't really want to say happy September 11th. You want to say it's good to talk to you on September 11th. I suppose that's right. It's good to talk to you, sir.
Yes, you as well, Seth. I was so grateful that you reached out. It's actually therapy for me to talk this through. I was telling someone on a call earlier this afternoon that I was going to be hopping on with you to talk about it. I said, I hope I'm going to be able to hold it together. And the person said, you know, this is just one of those days. You've just got to feel what needs to be felt.
Yeah, you do. And let it run. I've had a couple callers today who had trouble with it. And good they should. Good that we should. There's a range of emotions for those of us that remember it and were there and had our lives changed by it. And that's important. It's also important that we know that you have students in your school. You have students at Pepperdine who know nothing of it from firsthand, right? That have only the stories we tell or the stories that the culture tells. And you at Pepperdine do something important here. Unlike a lot of schools, places of higher education, you have something of the waves of flags. Do you want to tell us about that? Is that a good place to start?
Yeah, no, it is. It's actually one of the many evidences of God's work in my life is that I was in New York on that fateful day, and now work in an institution 3,000 miles away that I think commemorates 9/11 more poignantly than any school.
That's my sense. I mean, I was looking into this waves of flags. Yeah, you bet. I think you're right.
It started with a group of college Republicans and some folks from Young America's Freedom Foundation with a proposal soon after 9/11 to say, would it be possible to put flags commemorating each one who we lost on that day? And that's where it began. And now we've been doing it now for over, I think we were 16 years now. Obviously, today's the 19th anniversary, but I think we've been at it 15 or 16 years. Yeah. And if you drive down Pacific Coast Highway, you are met as you drive by the big green front lawn of the Pepperdine campus.
I know it well.
3,000 flags.
3,000 flags.
Yeah.
3,000 flags. Fantastic. I'll tell you, I was worried early on. Why don't you do your story? Because I know 9/11 changed you. Why don't you do yours, and then I'll tell you what I was worried about on that day. You were in New York. I was in Washington.
Yeah, I was working at a marketing advertising firm at 38th Street and 8th Avenue, commuted in from New Jersey, the suburbs where I was living, and got a phone call in the office soon after the first plane hit from one of the other staff members. It was a fairly small firm, but he lived across the street from the towers. And he's calling in just frantically saying, I'm not coming into the office. A plane has just hit the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I'm imagining a Cessna, you know. I'm thinking that this was some...
That's what we thought when we turned on the Today Show. That's what the Today Show folks were saying. That's what we thought. Right.
And I said, well, that's, I'm saying to myself as I'm hearing the conversation with the other staff member who's speaking, that, but, you know, didn't really think too much of it. And then he calls back... about 45 minutes or so later to say a second plane is hit and you've got to turn on the television.
Yeah.
And so sure enough, as soon as that second plane hit, all the phones were lit up and we're seeing now on the internet what's happening. And the president of this marketing firm just said, you know, that old last call, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Yeah.
And basically said, okay, you all need to leave. And of course I'd come in from New Jersey. They had shut down all the trains, the bridges, the tunnels and so forth. So I'm just kind of stuck there on Manhattan. But I had a good buddy of mine who was worked in the DA's office for the city of New York. And he was working out in Staten Island, and I called him up, and I said, Alan, can I crash at your place? Because I can't, there's no place for me to go. And he had an apartment up on the Upper East Side, 89th Street, between 2nd and 3rd Avenue. And I made the walk, maybe an hour and a half it took to go from 38th and 8th up to 89th. And it was just an amazing walk, right? I'm walking along and cars are coming up from downtown with sheetrock and white dust just falling off of them, you know, and people lined up at payphones because none of the cell phones were working, trying to communicate with people, telling them it's okay. All the while you're looking downtown and you're seeing this pall of brown, black smoke that's just coming, spilling into the air. And so I managed to get to his apartment and turned on the news and just stared at the television for 3 hours.
Right. Right.
And at one point I remember hearing a jet outside and just thinking to myself, wow, that's strange. I haven't heard any planes overhead. And of course I knew that things were being shut down. So I looked out of his apartment window and it was a military jet that was flying around the island of Manhattan, and it struck me, he's up there to shoot things down.
That's right. That's right.
Because if you remember, we didn't know there were just going to be two planes.
Oh, we had all kinds of things flying around. Flying around the chatter. We were told there were bombs going off in Lafayette Square and that there was going to be another wave. Yeah, yeah. We didn't know what was going on. Right.
So it just strikes me as I'm watching this Air Force jet flying around, it's like, how did we get in this place on this beautiful September day that started off in the office, and now the military's flying around looking to shoot down a possible passenger
plane? That's right. That's right. That's right.
And so I left the apartment, walked out into Central Park only a few blocks away, and again, it was that perfect day that everybody describes. You look uptown, kids and baby strollers and parents and people walking around, and then you look downtown at the smoke and you realize that the world's changing and you're not sure how, but you know that it is. And really was a major turning point in my own life in thinking about what was important and how I was going to spend the next, you know, God willing, three decades of a career.
Yeah.
So definitely a pivotal point in my own life. And we found out later we lost a close family personal friend there, and also somebody I knew from church. So definitely it was a very tough day and following the weeks.
It's interesting. Yeah, we a lot of us, almost everyone I know, not to a T, but almost everyone I know who lived in Washington or New York knew someone or knew someone who knew someone or was related to someone. With me, there were two degrees. There were two people. One I knew directly. Do you remember Barbara Olson? Her husband was the Solicitor General. I knew Barbara.
Yes.
And then, of course, I came to know someone I had mentioned earlier on the show. I got to know a Deborah Burlingame, whose brother Chick was one of the pilots on American Airlines 77. I got to know her, and of course, I've gotten to know Susan Rescorla. So I've gotten to know, and I did know one. But it's amazing with that loss that we did know, and it's amazing too that memory you have of thinking you were thinking about taking out a civilian airliner, that military. I was thinking, you know, I was thinking about ends as well, philosophical and heart tugging ends too. Thinking about those guys, the Beamers on Flight 93. You know, they knew. I have to go to break on this. We'll come back on it. But they knew if they were successful, they were going to take the plane down. The terrorists knew if they were successful, they were going to take the plane down too. What was the difference in the two thoughts? One was to take down the plane to save as many lives as possible, and one was to take down the plane to end as many lives as possible. Right? I mean, I think we... There's so much to it. Pete, you're the right guy to do it with. We'll be right back with more from Pete Peterson of the Pepperdine School of Public Policy. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Delighted to have with us Pete Peterson. He's the dean at the Pepperdine School of Public Policy. And was in New York on 9/11. It changed his life. And we were just having a conversation about different memories about all of this. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Pete, one of the many things I wanted to talk to you about, was an experience I had. I was in Washington D.C. when this took place, right across from the White House, and I was working over at a think tank. It's not there anymore. Empower America, Jack Kemp, Gene, and Bill Bennett, Gene Kirkpatrick, and Bill Bennett.
Sure.
And Bill, who had spent so much of his career in higher education, he pulled me aside out of a meeting the next day. We met. We went to the office on September 12th, and he pulled me aside, and he said, "We need to kind of change everything here." And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, we do taxes, foreign policy, and education, but we need to change everything on that with regard to 9/11. I said, "What do you think?" He says, "Well, you know, I was in college in the 60s, and there were these things called teach-ins. I knew what teach-ins were. You know what they are."
Yeah.
He said,
"Yeah.
We're going to need to do it in the opposite way." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, the teach-ins in the 60s were about how to avoid war. And we're going to need to go to the universities and explain to the students about why we need this war, why we need to go to war." And I said, "Hook me up." And we set up a meeting in Charles Krauthammer's office. It was Bill Barr, me, Bill Bennett. How fortunate was I to be in this group? Charles Krauthammer, Jim Woolsey, and I'm probably leaving out a person or two. I shouldn't be. Gene, I guess, was there. And we went on college campuses. We did tours of college campuses talking about radical Islam and the threat it posed to us. And the USA Today wrote a column on us, on our group. It was called "Americans for Victory Over Terrorism." And they said, "This is absurd. This is fear-mongering in the opposite direction. No one thinks that we don't need to go to war. The public view of what happened on 9/11 is strong and will remain stable." And we said, "You just watch. You just watch." And I remember reading a piece. Do you know a professor, Michael Lewis, over at Williams? He's an art professor. And he told a story in Commentary Magazine. A student from Williams who had graduated the year before, so had graduated in 2000, she was killed on 9/11. And the students did a class-wide, a school-wide at Williams College. Is that the most elite college in America? One of them, right? Top five, I would think. She did a school-wide memorial event for her. 200 students show. Michael Williams shows, and Michael Lewis shows. The president shows. And five people from the janitorial staff show. Not a single other professor shows up. Not a single one. I mean, the colleges and the universities went south. Remember Ward Churchill? And I was saying at the time, you know, this is extreme stuff. But you go through the faculty lounges and you just move one click to the right, and that's where most faculty are, not much more than one click to the right of him on this. It was a blame America first attitude. Still is.
Yeah. No, that's right, Seth. I can't think about this conversation without thinking of President Obama's former pastor talking about the chickens coming home to roost.
Right, that was right out of the Ward Churchill essay, you bet. Yeah.
And again, I think that kind of perspective, as much as, again, I think we do remember how close we were, the unity, the patriotism that we experienced in the months following, but that did not endure.
No.
And I think in ways I talk with students a lot here, you know, to your point, our students don't necessarily know firsthand about 9/11, but they're nonetheless shaped by it.
Yep.
You know, I gave a presentation earlier today on how 9/11 really did shape the world we're in ways that the pandemic is only building upon.
Yeah.
And so it's important to understand that the air we breathe was put there in part by those events, and that being the case, understanding the importance of our unity, which we are not seeing with this pandemic, as actually having national security implications. Now, I'm not saying that this should be demanded, but I think we also should count the cost that when we don't experience this unity as a nation, it does come with consequences.
Mm-hmm. Say more on that. Say more of what you told your students. This is a fascinating idea, concept to me, thesis to me. Talk to me a little bit more about what you said in your speech.
Well, so I'm talking about the fact that, you know, to your point about what's been taught in academia, now what we're seeing in things like the 1619 Project, they're inherently polarizing. And without really a chance for reconnection. And you and I have had a number of conversations about the loneliness levels, and this is all documented. This is social scientific research.
Isolation.
Showing
these
levels of disconnection.
Yeah.
But what 9/11 showed, and I believe what we're seeing now with the pandemic, and I'm just going to say, I hope it's not overly controversial, but the media has let us down in informing us of the threat from China.
Uh-huh. It's not controversial on this show.
Okay. So to me, if it's not possible for us to come together, then we are not going to be prepared to respond to threats that are real and comprehensive. And that's not to say, again, that there shouldn't be things that we look back on our history. Again, we've talked through this many times. I just think what 9/11 showed, and now what we're experiencing now, I think even in some deeper and broader ways, is that there's a cost to be paid if we're not able to flex our patriotic muscles.
And there's so much to this. There's a lot of strings on this guitar, Pete, because I'm thinking of two things immediately when you make that point. So let me tell you what I'm thinking, and we'll come back to it on the other side of this break, if that's okay.
Yep.
One is, the China thing. There were those that there were weird conspiracy theorists on 9/11 too, who were trying to say, well, we did this to ourselves. You could get Michael Moore's crap.
Yeah.
And you could get the nuts who said, well, this was an Israeli job, or the stuff was around. It was mostly ridiculed. I remind that Nancy Pelosi went to the opening of Fahrenheit 9/11, however. Today, the weird echo I have in my mind is Andrew Cuomo, who keeps talking about this as a European virus.
Yeah.
And it's just so odd. It's just so very, very odd. Because it's so very obviously in front of our eyes. Let me come back with you when we do come back. I'm Seth Leibson. He's Pete Peterson from the Pepperdine School of Public Policy. Pepperdine.edu is the website. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. For energy, improved health, boosted immunity, I want you to check out Balance of Nature. I take it every day. So do my friends. So does my family. You get mango and apples and bananas and kale and broccoli and garlic and tens of thousands of vital nutrients in just one daily dose. You energize yourself, you improve your health, you boost your immunity, and they have a great deal of Balance of Nature where they're offering free shipping and 35% off any new preferred order of their fruits and veggies. Check them out at balanceofnature.com. Make sure to use discount code BALANCE. We're talking to Pete Peterson from the Pepperdine School of Public Policy about 9/11 and some cultural thoughts and after effects. Pete, so yes, the China thing is a big part of this, and the concern you have about the distractions away from it. I worried about distractions on 9/11 too. You see it today. You hear it from Cuomo. The other weird thing that I can't get my arms around, Pete, is what's taken place in 19 years where we went from a ethic of let's roll to an ethic of let's curl up under a bed and hide. That, to me, too, this there wasn't. Anyway, you take my point.
Yeah, and I do think that some of that is related to our inability to understand the national security implications of the pandemic.
Okay.
Right? Imagine, if you will, that we actually did see this pandemic as something that was concocted in a military lab, released intentionally or accidentally. But once that happened, the government that released it did not make it evident or known to other places that could have...
Oh, they deliberately lied. Yeah, you can put it as strongly as you want, right? They
and
lied.
Then take
they
it to
lied.
The next...
Yeah.
And then to see the steps that country has taken now in sending masks and faulty medical equipment to countries around the world intending to develop their image as being essentially the alternative to America around the world.
Yep.
And I think if we really took that seriously, Seth, we would look very differently at what we're facing. And
because it's a national security threat, or at least it has severe national security implications, as opposed to those who are making a domestic partisan point of it as it's Donald Trump's fault.
And to take that even another step further, you know, you may have heard we've had a leaked recording here of our county health official in Los Angeles County who recently was recorded as saying the schools are not going to open until after the election.
After the election, right.
So this is something.
I'm glad that came out because I tell you, I've been saying when people say, when will this end? I said November 4th. Either way, whatever the outcome of the election, November 4th is when we'll stop hearing about it.
But again, the politicization of this pandemic, I think, is a natural result of the increasing politicization of the country and our inability, as I used the phrase before and can't come up with anything better, to flex our patriotic muscle in times that demand it.
Yeah. Yeah. And we did have it, as you point out, 19 years ago for about 3 months.
Yep.
I mean, we actually quantified it at one point. We quantified that Bible sales were through the roof. We quantified that AA meetings and 12-step meetings were standing room only in a movement that says we always have a chair for you. We quantified that divorce attorneys were saying people were pulling back their filings. It was real. It was real. And then the year came and changed. Al Gore gave a speech closer to you than to me up at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco about almost exactly a year after 9/11, 2001. It was September of 2002. And he was talking about the Bush administration engaging in the kinds of wars the Soviet Union engaged in when they were talking about preemption attack. And he said the U.S. should never do what George Bush is talking about. It's what the Soviet Union did to Afghanistan in the first place. And I said, there it is. That's where we lost it. Right there, when we compared George Bush to Leonid Brezhnev. I got to take this a quick segment. You can stick around a little longer?
Yeah, for sure.
Thanks. We'll be right back with Pete Peterson. Here's a little Peter Gunn. It's a great market if you're thinking about selling your house, but what's important is not the market necessarily, it's the marketing. And for that, you want James Wexler of JMG Real Estate. With James Wexler, you'll get the highest possible offer on the sale of your home. James Wexler sells more homes over $500,000 than any other agent in Phoenix and Scottsdale. He does it through a proprietary and state-of-the-art marketing technology, which enables his customers' homes to be viewed by the widest pool of qualified buyers. As a result, his listings sell faster and for more money than any other agent. Give him a call at 480-386-0711. He guarantees to sell your home at market value or he'll pay the difference. Visit him at jameswexler.com. Jameswexler.com. We're talking to Pete Peterson, Pepperdine School of Public Policy. Pete, I think as 9/11 became political, basically starting in the year 2002, and the left made it so, the Democrats made it so, happened here too, as you point out, with the coronavirus, with huge and severe national security implications. It's eerie to me because I don't know. Did you see the Showtime, was it Showtime or it was HBO, the HBO series on Chernobyl last year?
I didn't.
I'm very familiar with it. Yeah, series. Very much worth seeing. A lot of people were reminded about the lies the Soviet Union engaged in, and I was relating it to the kinds of lies that China was engaging in. And I was thinking about 9/11 because one of the things some of us said after 9/11, and we were wrong, was that this postmodern era of there being no such thing as truth anymore vanished on 9/11. We were wrong about that. We were wrong. We thought good and evil had been so tangible, so evident, so immanentized, if I can, that this pseudo-sophisticated notion of there being no such thing as truth and good and evil can be matters of subjection was gone. And it wasn't, was it? I mean, you and I saw it clearly, but a lot of the country didn't.
And related to that, Seth, I mean, the fact that we weren't really at the end of history either.
Right.
So there were two parts of that. The waking up from the fact that there are others who want to do America harm. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there was the beginning of the awareness that American hegemony was under attack. And if you think about it, back in that time, those were also the heady days when we all believed that engagement, not to belabor this point, but it's certainly relevant from a timing perspective, that engagement with China and bringing them into the World Trade Organization and engaging them in trade was going to bring all these other great benefits of liberty that we would expect when economic liberation can engender political liberation. So there are actually many streams happening there that originated on this day 19 years ago.
You know, you mentioned the end of history. I'll never get this out of my head. Probably we just keep reminding each other of things. There's so much here. That book, that thesis of Francis Fukuyama's, I was going back through it after 9/11. And do you know he, in that long book on having reached the end of history, he had one mention of the Arab world. And this is what he wrote. Can I tell you? I have it in front of me.
Yes, that's great.
One mention. He, quote, "It is hard to believe that the Muslim movement in the Arab world will take on any universal significance. Close quote. And that was it. Even the preachers of the end of history, you know, got it wrong and just totally discounted the power of, you know, basically Nazi ideology in the hands of radical religion.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know what meme may have started it, but I've noticed several times on my Twitter feed people trying to name the best year in their life, you know, and there are people in their 40s and 50s, and everyone saying that late 90s period was just kind of the golden era.
Holiday from history, Charles Krauthammer called it.
And that right there, Seth, is what it was.
Yep. Right? Holiday from history.
And 9/11 changed that, and now we're seeing it again.
Yep. Yeah,
And I think I told you at one point, one of our recent conversations, we saw a doubling of applications here to the policy school during the pandemic, the first stages of the pandemic last spring. And my hope is that if there is any sort of silver lining here, that there is an awareness that we haven't been on a holiday from history in these last few years either.
What do you attribute that to? People wanting to better themselves or what? Improve their...
No, well, in my line of work, yeah. You know, it's not like with some exceptions who are notable, you don't get in the policy world for money, right?
Correct.
And so for us, what
I'm seeing... Thousandfold poverty, indeed. I think that's what Socrates said, right?
But what I see in the applications are this awareness, and I think it's been brought on by the pandemic, that this is a multi-layer policy and political crisis.
Okay.
That is not just international relations. It's also what's going on at the county level. It's what's happening in our states and certainly at the federal level as well. And this awareness that, and it's the awareness that I came to on this day 19 years ago, standing in the middle of Central Park looking down at the brown smoke, that there's a much bigger world out there that I need to be aware of and not only aware of, but engaged in.
Yeah. You and I know a bunch of people like this, Pete. He lives in Southern California. Do you know he's a comedian by trade, but he's now taken to written some great books. Evan Sayet. Do you know Evan at all?
Oh, yeah, sure.
And
he
tells this story, too. He says 9/11 changed him forever and changed his politics forever, too. You know, he listened to that kind of crud that Al Gore was spewing, and he realized this can't be my party anymore. America is not at fault here. What Gene Kirkpatrick was warning about in the Blame America First attitude, or what the Jeremiah Wrights were fulminating about later, obviously.
But isn't that ironic, Seth, that we're doing the same thing again?
Yes.
It's our fault. This pandemic is our fault.
Oh, yes.
And
How many Facebook postings talking about how America is doing the worst in the world, you know?
Oh, goodness.
Right. Our fault, the worst in the world. And what's this Cuomo business about the European virus? What is that about? You know, Pete, if you have visitors this weekend who are coming to you from Canada, Toronto, and they stop at a layover in Detroit, you don't say you have friends coming in from Detroit.
I know.
This is the world.
And then to look at where the tracks came in Europe.
Yeah.
And they followed pretty closely to the Chinese trade and engagement routes there, too.
Pete, you're the best. God bless you.
Thank you, sir.
Lots of love and courage and hope. Have a great weekend, sir. Thanks for spending
Seth.
Of your day with us.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Yesterday I was making the point that we could all use a little more Winston Churchill and a little less Ward Churchill. And I don't just mean the individuals, but I meant the philosophies for which they stood and the outlooks for which they lived. I love reading what Winston Churchill wrote in his third volume of his World War II memoirs about his thoughts when he heard that Pearl Harbor was bombed. He wrote, "Hitler's fate was sealed. Mussolini's fate was sealed. As for the Japanese, they would be ground to powder. Silly people, and there were many, not only in enemy countries, might discount the force of the United States. Some said they were soft, others that they would never be united. They would fool around at a distance. They would never come to grips. They would never stand bloodletting. Their democracy and system of recurrent elections would paralyze their war effort. They would be just a vague blur on the horizon to friend or foe. Now we should see the weakness of this numerous but remote, wealthy, and talkative people. But I had studied the American Civil War, fought out to the last desperate inch. American blood flowed in my veins. And I thought of a remark which Edward Gray had made to me more than 30 years before, that the United States is like a gigantic boiler. Once the fire is lighted under it, there is no limit to the power it can generate. Being saturated and satiated with emotion and sensation, I went to bed and slept the sleep of the saved and thankful. Be like Churchill. Don't be like the silly people. God bless you all. Till Monday. Class dismissed.